It was a pleasant day on an unknown date in the second half of 1257. The weather was mild, and Archbishop Conrad von Hochstaden was sitting in the Cologne Cathedral courtyard, directly in front of the construction site of the Gothic choir, and holding court. As a supreme ruler of the city, he exercised high jurisdiction in Cologne and could therefore hear cases involving severe corporal punishment and even death. So while he was pondering a case, surrounded by a large number of onlookers from Cologne and advised by his jurors, he had no idea what was about to happen. As two jurors were talking next to him, the archbishop's gaze wandered across the cathedral courtyard and caught sight of the cathedral canon Heinrich von der Neuerburg, a relative of the archbishop. Both eyes met, and Heinrich saw that this as a sign to approach Conrad. But just before the cathedral canon reached the archbishop, several men suddenly burst out of the crowd and started beating the cathedral canon Heinrich. Conrad von Hochstaden is horrified. An attack while he is sitting here in court, in close proximity to him. Was the attack really aimed at his relative? Or was it even aimed to him, as the attackers had chosen the cathedral courtyard as the scene of the attack? Well, we don't know for sure, but the scuffle did not last long. The archbishop's guards beat the attackers and they escaped in the turmoil. But although the attack was not aimed at him, the archbishop, directly, but at his relative, the city lord was gripped by fear. What if more attackers were to come soon? The archbishop had recognized who the attackers had been, and Conrad entered the trial immediately and adjourned it. He then instructed his servants to get ready to leave the city immediately. He would travel to nearby Bonn to get armed help. Then he would finally settle accounts with these rebellious inhabitants of Cologne when he would return. How could they, the people of Cologne, dare to disturb his court session? Conrad thought, even to cause him almost physical harm. That was an affront. It was a betrayal of the rightful lord of the city, Conrad himself. But why had there been a brawl in the cathedral courtyard here in 1257? A scuffle that would soon erupt into greater violence. A new chapter between citizenry versus archbishop enters another round here in the 13th century. You'll find out in a moment. And with that, welcome back to the History of Cologne, a podcast about the city of Cologne, today's Western Germany that is over 2,000 years old. But until it became what it is today, this old city on the Rhine has endured a colorful orange past, hence it can therefore be seen as a microcosm of European history. In this podcast, you can listen as the city grows from the Romans up until our present time. What was that commotion at the beginning of the episode in 1257? A brawl right under the archbishop's nose, at a relative of the city's ruler. We know who was attacked, but who were the attackers? The attackers were members of Cologne's prestigious Kleingedank family, one of the city's most powerful burgher families. We briefly introduced the Kleingedanks once before, but that was a while ago, so here's a quick refresher. First of all, the name of this family, Kleingedank. In other words, translated to English, meaning small thinkers. A euphemism for the family describing themselves as stupid? Well, whatever the reason is for the name, it was not flattering at first glance. Nevertheless, the family members of the Kleingedank wore it proudly. Unlike the Overstolzen family, who only came to wealth, prestige and above all power in the 13th century, the Kleingedanks had risen to the ranks of the city's later powerful 15 families early on in the 12th century already. They were widely ramified in the city with possessions and family members. More than almost any other family, the Kleingedanks had a keen instinct for marrying off their children to the city's upper middle class and gaining more power and influence, a little bit like the Habsburgs later would do in all of Europe. At the time of the events of this episode, Gerhard Rufus Kleingedank was the head of the clan. It was probably one of his sons who led the fatal attack on the cathedral canon Heinrich von der Neuerburg. And now it gets complicated again, because the son of Kleingedank, who was the attacker, is also called Heinrich, or Henry in English. So, Heinrich attacked Heinrich. Let's not make this any more complicated than it already is. So, the Kleingedanks were to hold office in the city of Cologne until well into the 16th century. After that, their trail disappears in history. In any case, I haven't found anything more about them. They are probably still descendants, but they branched out more and more over the centuries so that the original identity and name Kleingedank were probably lost. But back to 1257, the year in the history of the Kleingedanks, when they would have a major impact on Cologne's history with their attack on the cathedral canon and relative of Archbishop Konrad von Hochstaden, Heinrich von der Neuerburg. The Kleingedank family attack here in 1257 was no coincidence, but a calculated act of revenge. A few months earlier, Hermann Kleingedank, a member of this family, had been attacked and captured on the Moselle River by a relative of the Archbishop of Cologne, so way down south of Cologne. The raid was intended to collect debts from other Cologne citizens, a common albeit brutal practice at the time. It had nothing to do with the Kleingedanks themselves. Hermann Kleingedank was simply unlucky to have been in the wrong place at the wrong time as a citizen of Cologne. But above all, the fact that they had done nothing wrong made sure of that. The Kleingedanks wanted to return the favor with the attack we were already familiar with. An action to save face and restore the family's honor. As always, don't forget, honor was everything at the time. But this endeavor, well, had serious consequences. The Archbishop therefore saw himself under attack, and not without good reason after this brawl had happened. He fled directly from Cologne and travelled to Bonn, a city south of Cologne. Initially shocked, Konrad of Hochstaden, or von Hochstaden, ultimately became furious. He had fled his own city in a hurry, and now he learned through messengers from Cologne that the citizens of Cologne were united on the side of the Kleingedank family that had done him wrong in his eyes, because he had not known that one of his relatives down somewhere far away from Cologne in the Moselle region had kidnapped one of the Kleingedanks. So he really thought he was on the right side of history. Apparently, well, the Kleingedanks thought so too, and they thought it was okay to repay that incident that happened on the Moselle region, on Moselle River. Sorry. So let's continue. The city lord and Archbishop of Cologne immediately gathered 400 armed horsemen. He wanted to recapture Cologne. Now, Konrad von Hochstaden, as you already know, was no fool. After being nearly the Archbishop of 20 years of Cologne, he knew that the city wall of Cologne was impregnable. As I said, until 1794, no foreign enemy army would be able to successfully overcome Cologne's city wall. So if he were to march towards Cologne with an army, no matter how large it might be, it would be noticed from afar. Banners in the air, a large, slow logistical troop with rations, servants and maids to supply the army, and above all, the infantry marching on foot. That would give Cologne enough time. Bonn was not far away from Cologne. Logically, it isn't today either, but there would still be enough time in the city to prepare for an approaching army from the immediate neighborhood. The storm bells would ring in the city. In the wards, people would gather under arms in their district houses. The city gates would be closed long before the archiepiscopal army arrived in Cologne, and then around 10,000 men from Cologne up to arms would be posted on Europe's largest medieval city wall to date, an impregnable fortress. But what, Konrad von Hochstaden wondered, if the city was taken by surprise with a lightning strike, blitzkrieg, so to speak? After all, the city could not simply be ready for war from one second to the another. Here too, it would take time to gather all the men under arms, position them on the walls and ramparts, and close the city gates. Couldn't the people of Cologne be taken by surprise with a small but powerful and mobile unit? This seemed like a good idea to Konrad von Hochstaden, and he put the plan to action. Of course, a plan like this only works if the element of surprise is on your side, but somehow the citizens of Cologne managed to find out about their city ruler's plan. Shortly before the Severance Gate was reached, the gate whose street still leads to Bonn today, a surprise attack came from Cologne itself. Don't forget, the upper middle class of the city now saw themselves as the city nobility. They lived in splendid stone houses, dressed like the nobility, increasingly cultivated manners like the nobility, and above all, armed themselves and fought like the nobility, even though they were not the nobility after all. Archbishop Konrad von Hochstein was therefore astonished when a contingent of mounted fighters, the richest of whom were even wearing knight's armor, gave them a good spanking. The archbishop realized that his plan was not working and quickly ordered a retreat back to Bonn, 1-0 in favor of the citizens of Cologne. The skirmish directly in the south of Cologne ended in favor of the Cologne citizens. But here too, it became clear that this did not end the conflict. On the contrary, it now became more drastic. What were they actually arguing about? Was it triggered by a misunderstanding and a fact that could have been resolved in court or through arbitration? Now, this feud had escalated into a regional conflict with at least several deaths already. Simply because first the Kleingedanks and then the archbishop felt that their honor had been insulted. The city was now in the hands of the citizens for the moment. The surrounding countryside, however, directly in front of the city walls, was not. That remained under the control of the archbishop, Konrad von Hochstaden, immediately capitalized on this. From then on, the archbishop's army camped outside Cologne and closed off all roads leading to Cologne. No one could get in or out. The city, which could not be stormed due to its fortifications, was to be starved out. Not exactly cool, thought the people of Cologne in particular. The citizens immediately hired a general to help the city break through the archbishop's blockade, and the choice fell on the nobleman Dietrich von Falkenburg, a noble family from the area around Aachen, the Falkenburgs. The city's choice of commander is perhaps somewhat ironic for anyone familiar with Cologne's history, because the aforementioned Dietrich von Falkenburg was the brother of the future Archbishop of Cologne, who would also have a lot of disputes with the city in the near future. But well, that was still a long way off in 1257, and nobody could have known that back then. Dietrich von Falkenburg therefore took over the military command for the defense of the city of Cologne and attempted to break through the blockade with a targeted attack at a neuralgic point in the blockade and thus bring it down altogether. There was a bloody battle between the people of Cologne and the archbishop's troops near Frechen, which is a town in the west of Cologne, which the town, well, the city of Cologne won militarily, but did not bring the hoped for benefits in ending the conflict, in breaking the blockade. Because Konrad von Hochstaden had managed to bring other regional players into the conflict, powerful regional players. Players who allied themselves now with him, the archbishop. Something that the city was actually happy to do in order to put the archbishop under pressure, so they always like to do that. If the archbishop was threatening them, they always seeked alliances with other regional rulers. But now, yeah, the city lord used a reverse card and now used this method himself for his own goals. With the Duke of Limburg, his relatives, the Count of Berg and the Count of Jülich, the Archbishop of Cologne had virtually all the powerful partners in the region around Cologne on his side on 2nd October 1257, and they swore to him that they would help him fight against his rebellious city, against Cologne. But of course, they, the people of Cologne, didn't give up so easily. Perhaps they wanted to gain an advantage in possible peace negotiations in the future in this very hopeless political situation. But we have to bear this in mind again. The citizenry of Cologne did not exist as a centralized body that spoke with one voice or made unanimous decisions. No, there seems to have been disagreement within the city's population as to how to deal with the new, very threatening situation. Without consulting the richest members of the citizenry, a group of around several dozen Cologne citizens therefore set off for Deutz on the other side of the Rhine River in the autumn of 1257. Deutz was under the control of the archbishop as well, and the monastery there, together with the associated secular rights over the town of Deutz, had been transferred as a fief to the Counts of Berg. From there, the Cologne band of armed Cologne citizens invaded deeper into Berg territory without the approval of the families, meaning the richest families of the city, and devastated the countryside. The alleged aim was probably to capture firewood in the territory of the Counts of Berg, who had sided now with the Archbishop, which had certainly, firewood had certainly become scarce in the city due to the sealing off of Cologne because of the blockade. However, this aggressive Cologne timber drive into the right bank of the Rhine, up the Scherzig, as we say in Cologne, to put it mildly, went badly wrong. Berg peasants and troops of the Count of Berg put the Cologne mob to flight, who suffered heavy losses. 50 Cologne soldiers, 50 Cologne citizens were killed as the scattered remnants fled back across the Rhine to Cologne. And here too, you might have thought that the whole thing wasn't tragic enough. Not at all. Now the families, the higher citizens of the city, felt compelled to restore the lost honor of the citizenry. With a larger contingent, this time with the participation of the city's upper families as well, they once again marched to the other side of the Rhine in autumn of 1257, set fire to everything again, and recovered the bodies of the 50 Cologne citizens who had fallen earlier. The people of Cologne also set fire to Archbishop Heribert's monastery in Deutz, founded around the year 1000. We had a podcast episode about that, as Count Adolf IV of Berg had entrenched himself here in an attempt to fend off the new attack by the people of Cologne. The Count of Berg had to flee from the burning town of Deutz, but at least he escaped with his life. When the Cologne citizens crossed back to Cologne and saw the burning Deutz on the Rhine River during the crossing, resignation nevertheless spread among them. Once they arrived in the city, they suffered from hunger and the lack of necessary raw materials, especially, after all, firewood. The richest families in the city, including the Overstolzen family, the Weisen von der Mühlengasse, and a good dozen other families, faced up to the unthinkable. It couldn't go on like this. Why were they fighting here at all? Especially for what? Should the whole city suffer because of the wounded honor of a single Cologne family? A family of the Kleingedanks? The Kleingedanks will probably not have been overly enthusiastic about this decision, but of course they had to bow to the overwhelming majority of the city's most powerful families. Messengers from Cologne were sent to inform the Archbishop that peace was requested from the city's ruler. Conrad von Hochstaden accepted the offer, with a few conditions, of course. The following points were agreed in Bonn. The Kleingedank family had to appear before the Archbishop in penitential clothes on 17th March of 1258 and ask for his forgiveness, for the Archbishop's forgiveness. You may remember this request by the Archbishop, this public humiliation of the defeated opponent from the uprising against Archbishop Anno in 1074, but here it was left at just humiliation. No one's eyes were gouged out, or nobody got whipped, as in 1074. And, after all, the family of the Kleingedanks were allowed to stay, and stay in power as well. Not dressed as penitents, but just as humbly, all of the city's respected and wealthy citizens were forced to imitate the Kleingedanks and publicly ask the Archbishop and Lord of the city of Cologne for forgiveness as well. The procession started at the southern Severn Gate and traveled a few kilometers outside the city to the so-called Judenbüche, where the Archbishop received the people of Cologne. We have already mentioned the Judenbüche here. Originally the cemetery of Cologne's Jewish community, the site was also often used as a place of execution, a circumstance that the Jewish community, understandably, found outrageous and complained about. The citizens had to swear that they would once again regard Conrad von Hochstaden as the lord of the city and pay homage to him. In return, the Archbishop promised to protect his citizens, or how he saw it, his subjects, to the best of his ability. He had this privilege honored with an extremely large sum of money that the citizens had to pay him. In this peace agreement, the city ruler came off much better than the citizens. So this round in early 1258 was a loss for the citizens of Cologne in their pursuit of more autonomy. But after this was settled, in this way, dear people, equality was restored in the eyes of the town. The citizens had received their peace, as they requested, and made atonement with the high monetary payment. The archbishop had had his honor restored and was the winner of this dispute, even in reality. Now the next step could be taken to create a new balance between the two sides, between the citizens and the city ruler. You can guess what happened now. Exactly, a new arbitration award was needed. On 20th March 1258, just a few days after the peace agreement was agreed, a new court of arbitration was set up under the leadership of Albertus Magnus, of course. Albertus Magnus was once again involved in 1258, as he had been in the previous arbitration of 1252, that we already talked about. Four aristocratic arbitrators assisted the Dominican monk Albertus Magnus. Now, we always have this stereotype that the Middle Ages were despotic types, but no, in my eyes, this arbitration process was genuinely fair. Both sides, the city and the archbishop, were allowed to submit their claims written down against the other side to the court of arbitration. The panel of five men examined the claims and then issued a judgment about that, about every single point. Fancy an example? Well, let's start with the archbishop. He will cite more than twice as many points of complaint as the other side, so the city of Cologne. Above all, he feels in general that his traditional rights as a city ruler have been violated. The citizens of Cologne had arbitrarily usurped powers over the city that he was entitled to. He also complained that the magistrates, who were sworn to him personally as legal advisors and municipal officials, were on the side of the citizenry most of the time rather than his. And keep that accusation in mind, the collegiate of magistrates would soon face a major purge as a result by Konrad von Hochstaden when the time was right for him. In his overall 53 complaints, the archbishop criticized in his 23rd complaint that he had no precise overview of the taxes collected by the citizens in the city and demanded disclosure and sensible use for the common good. So what the archbishop does is saying the rich citizens of Cologne are abusing their power and the poor citizens of the city or the poor inhabitants of the cities are not profiting from that rule of the rich people of Cologne. It is really irony that the archbishop of Cologne sees himself as the fighter for the poor and the neglected against the rich or the richer citizens of Cologne. But what does he now say exactly in his complaints, in complaint number 23? Quote, "Furthermore, those who collect taxes, fees, and revenues from the city," so he means the citizens or the magistrates, "must give a public account every year, and what is found to be available should be placed in the public coffers so that it can be spent for the benefit of the community," end quote. The referees examined the facts of the case and answered this point as follows. Quote, "Furthermore, we say that they," so the citizens, "collect taxes, city revenues or fees, etc. Honorable and trustworthy men must be elected by the community and some from the magistrates, the brotherhoods and the other citizens, under their supervision, under three keys and seal is what is collected, and they are required to render an account four times a year so that they always render an account after 3 months. These accounts shall be attended by 12 jurors, 12 brother masters, and 12 of the other citizens. And it is incumbent on their prudence and loyalty that what they find is used only for the benefit of the community." End quote. As you can see, the archbishop's desire for transparency is being honored by the referees, the court of arbitration. However, the autonomy to demonstrate this transparency independently to the citizenry is left. And of course, like Albertus Magnus, we want to take a neutral position here and give an example of complaint from the people of Cologne to the city ruler as well. They only had 21 points of complaints compared to the total of 53 points of complaints by the Archbishop. Nevertheless, the frustration on the part of the people of Cologne was deep. They complained in general of unlawful interference with trade, unjustified customs, duties, corrupt officials, and even arbitrary arrests of Cologne citizens throughout the Archbishop's territory in the Rhineland and Westphalia. Here, I would like to quote their very first complaint. Quote, "The city of Cologne submits that the Archbishop sometimes issues documents against the law and privileges of this city, according to which Cologne citizens can be imprisoned and also seized because of his debts, with impunity and without offending him, as we can demonstrate and prove by many facts." End quote. This is the very first complaint cited by the people of Cologne here. It was a common practice at the time, but the people of Cologne were simply not prepared to be liable for the debts of their lord, as stated here. What does that mean? Imagine going on holiday or on vacation somewhere and being kidnapped, and then you are told that you have to pay for your mayor's or president's debt. You wouldn't think that was cool either, would you? Because private property exists. Hope that private property exists in the place where you live right now. The Court of Arbitration issues the following ruling, which is clearly, regarding this point, in favor of the citizens. Quote, "Furthermore, we say that the citizens of Cologne argue that the Archbishop issued documents against the law and privileges according to which Cologne citizens could be imprisoned or seized because of his debts, etc., because the Lord Archbishop must protect his own rather than hand them over to foreign hands." End quote. Here you can see a clear advocacy in favor of the citizens of Cologne. All in all, Albertus Magnus, as the head of this court of arbitration, remains true to his previous line. He does everything possible to strengthen and appease the Archbishop in his previous rights as Cologne city ruler. However, in many of his arbitration judgments, he promised the citizens on the other side that they could hope for equality and a strengthening of their political rights in the near future. How long would this new arbitration agreement last? We'll soon find out. But first, this arbitration agreement was solemnly proclaimed and agreed on. As there had already been an arbitration award in 1252 in the recent past, and this was now larger in 1258 with all those complaints written down and answered, it went down in history in 1258 as the Great Arbitration. And its predecessor from 1252 was then known as the Small Arbitration. On 28th of June 1258, a few weeks after the peace treaty was signed, a large crowd gathered in the Archbishop's palace, out into the cathedral courtyard and in front of Cologne Cathedral, the place where this conflict had once begun. First, the claims of both sides were announced aloud, as already briefly outlined here. This was followed by the arbitration awards on all points of the claim, also as also briefly outlined above. All in all, the Great Sheet, the Große Sheet, as we say in German, the Great Arbitration, states that there are institutions and bodies in Cologne that have their justification and are provided by the citizenry. The Richterzeche, for example, the city council, and also the magistrates were granted the greatest possible degree of self-administration in exercising their administrative functions in the city. Nevertheless, the Archbishop was the supreme ruler of the city. However, he did not have to intervene in the day-to-day running of politics in the city. He was not an absolutistic ruler, something that Conrad von Hochstaden had dreamed of to achieve in his nearly 20 years of office, being the Archbishop of Cologne. Rather, as a kind of supervisor, he was to ensure that the bodies dominated by the citizenry carried out their work lawfully and in the interests of the common good. Dear people, this last aspect, that the Archbishop was responsible for overseeing whether municipal bodies acted in the public interest, in the interest of the common good, that he was authorized to intervene then, should they engage in political abuse. was soon to be rigorously exploited by the Archbishop Conrad von Hochstaden to his own advantage. He was to decide for himself when this case would have occurred. It was a loophole that allowed him to intervene politically in the city if he wanted to. So what looked like the perfect compromise here, safeguarding civic self-government and confirming the archbishop's traditional rights, actually harbored a dangerous lever that could undermine this balance at any time. And from Conrad von Hochstaden's point of view, who could blame him for trying? The archbishops always wanted to turn back the clock, to be unrestricted masters of their own domain again, like Archbishop Brunner in the 10th century. Especially over their own royal seat, I mean not royal seat, but the bishop's seat. Conrad von Hochstaden would soon come closer to this goal than any other archbishop after him. Regardless of this, and sorry for the spoiler, the great arbitration, that große Schied will fail pretty soon. The great arbitration still passed in 1258. It is an important and indeed one of the most important legal documents of the Middle Ages. And even if it fails, as I already said, it was an important milestone in the history of Cologne, because for even though it confirmed the archbishop's power over Cologne, it now made it absolutely clear that the citizenry, with its institutions and citizens, were also an indispensable element of the city's rule, and nothing in this world would be able to change that regarding to the document. The clock cannot be turned back. Another step towards becoming a free imperial city that had been taken. This decision was not only a success for the citizens of Cologne, but also a signal to other cities of the Holy Roman Empire that urban autonomy and the rights of citizens could be defended and recognized, even in the midst of feudal structures. And I am repeating myself, I know, but even though the great arbitration, the Große Schied, would fail pretty soon, the genie was out of the bottle, and Cologne's citizens would always fight for their autonomy. Well, let's leave it for this time. I hope you had a good start into 2025. I hope you enjoyed this partly legal excursion, as literature, of course, served me Hugo Stehkämpers and Karl Dietmar's Köln im Hochmittelalter, meaning Cologne in the High Middle Ages. And I found the full text of the Große Schied, the Great Arbitration, in an edited and above all High German translation in Dieter Strauss, Der Große Schied von 1258, Erzbischof und Bürger im Kampf um die Kölner Stadtverfassung, meaning the Great Arbitration of 1258, Archbishop and citizens fighting about Cologne city's political system, so to speak. Thanks to the library of the Cologne City Museum for letting me read this book at such short notice, because it's not available anymore on the market or in any public library. And thanks for the coffee as well. Many thanks this time to Andrea, Mark, Sabine, Jan, Boris, Sylvia and Karl Adolf for your tips via PayPal. A warm welcome to Helga, who is now supporting me long-term on patreon.com. Thank you very much. Please recommend this podcast further, if you haven't already. Rate it on the podcast platform you prefer. And yeah, as always, auf Wiedersehen. Till next time.